Hello and welcome to the With a Terrible Fate podcast. I'm Dan.
I'm Cloud. No, I'm Aaron.
No, you're
I'm
one of
Zach.
Those.
My brain.
You're one of those sad pale fellas I've seen walking around.
Ex sad pale fella.
Oh, that's right. I'm sorry. Here's your $2,000 bill.
Thank you.
Well, if that didn't give it away, we're going to be talking about Final Fantasy VII Rebirth. But because we are going
they
to
all
be...
finished it by now, right? I mean, no one takes longer than like a week to finish a 10-hour game.
It's a 98% platinum rate right now. Everybody's just breezed through it. But we're going to be talking about it. And of course, I don't think that we could talk about it without spoilers, honestly. We like it or not.
I mean, people could conceivably. I don't think
not
we
us.
Could.
Yeah.
No.
So we're going to dive in. But before that, we are, of course, going to plug a very fun upcoming event and make sure that you get that into your ear holes before we start spoiling what happened to Cloud and gang.
Yes, it is one of our staples, although one of our staples will not be there with us, which will be sad. I'm already like missing you with anticipation, which I know, Dan.
I'm bummed to miss this one.
I know, but so it goes. But we'll have blood that we haven't in a while, which is good. Talking about the wonderful convention we go to in Boston every year, PAX East, which is happening this coming weekend, time of recording. And I'm sure we'll get this out before then. But yeah, our mutual dear friend and colleague, Matt McGill, is going to be joining me to talk all about bosses, which should be a lot of fun. We've been in the war room working on it. I'm going to be turning around and doing more right after this podcast. But talking very thoughtfully and deliberately about a wider range of games in more ways than one than we usually do, which should be very cool. Got a lot of unusual and challenging examples of what might constitute a boss and what makes it interesting. A lot of what, you know, for people like us is part and parcel of what makes gaming so cool. So still got to get the official announcement out on the site because, oh my goodness, it has been a busy time of year. But we're going to be giving the lecture at 3:30 p.m. on Friday, if anyone happens to be there, and certainly going to be uploading it to YouTube like we did with PAX West and like we usually try to do to be able to share it with people and chat about it afterwards. So should be a lot of fun.
Awesome.
And you know this, Dan, it's more than anything about the conversations we have afterwards. So I'm looking forward to chatting with gamers.
Part. Oh yeah. Is this one streamed?
No, it's not, but okay. I'm going to be the man with a camcorder. Though. Yeah.
Good. You know, good.
The old drill.
Very good. Well, I'm looking forward to the upload. Yeah. I'm going to be missing this one just because per our last episode, I got married, so my coffers are
going to say
bare.
That's the other update we need.
Yeah,
I mean,
yeah.
I figure you must be absolutely ripped in one hand now, lugging around that, you know, big new accessory that you have.
I'll say this, it's
we play Dark Souls, we know it's all about the rings.
Yeah, I got Havel's ring for my, yeah, it's
oh,
funny.
Increasing your ability to bear burdens. I guess that can be poetic or a dig, depending on how you look at it.
All right, I got the body type for it. The I always fat roll, but the it was an awesome ceremony, and very happy to be on the other side of it, be a married man, and here we are. So yeah, we'll be having a well, actually. I don't, well, we'll see. We'll see about our schedule because with Aaron doing PAX, we might just kind of stagger it a little bit, but it's, we're now that Final Fantasy VII Rebirth is done and we can, you know, take the cone of silence off. Here's something I want to talk about before we dive into spoilers. Mm-hmm. Isn't it hilarious that you and I, so Aaron and I talk every day, basically. And it was so funny that we just had this like 2 week period where like we didn't say anything to each other for fear of accidentally spoiling where we would be in Final
Fantasy
VII. I missed
you. It was so funny because we went to fucking Japan together for 2 weeks at the start of this year. And then I did your wedding. And then I woke up like every day for a week and a half. And I was like, oh, damn, I wonder how Dan's doing. But yeah, well, it's funny too, because like I think we both just know each other sufficiently well at this point, because I remember on the way out of Boston for your wedding, we had a conversation where we were saying, oh, okay, well, we can have a rule of saying which chapter we've completed up to this point, so that then we can talk about things. But then I think we both kind of got a sense that that maybe wouldn't be sufficient, because we wanted to be really safe in the cone of silence.
And yes. So, yeah.
Yeah. I think maybe we exchanged all of like literally two messages before we were both done with it.
And I think I saw your tweet saying you rolled credits before I saw your message to me, where it was like,
oh, that's funny.
Yeah. I was like, oh, okay, good. I can talk to him again. You know, but then I was like, I was so wrapped up because this is a long, long game.
Yes.
And I was maybe, so there's 14 chapters, and I mean, honestly, I would say like each of them is what, like, what would you say are in like 10 hours, like 8-10 hours?
At a minimum, if you're doing everything at a minimum. Yeah.
Yeah. So, you know, I was like a couple days out from being able to put my thoughts together. And I think that I was saying to my brother, Matt, who he was behind me, we would be talking about things, and there would be times where he would say something and I would just go quiet because I didn't even want to give any kind of indication of like, oh, that's an interesting thought, or like, oh, hang on to that, you know, or, oh, wait for that. Cause I was like, I don't want to give anything away. So,
yeah, I had a similar experience because I don't know if you clocked this. I assumed you would just kind of get a notification, but anyway, I finally, after like months and probably years of threatening to do this, got my butt together to make a community Discord for With a Terrible Fate. And reason, hilariously, was because we started preemptively, frankly, clogging up too much of the conversation on the Tales of Praxis stream with just anticipation for Final Fantasy VII Rebirth. And so shout out to one of our regulars, Pottery, who was like, hey, you know, you should really just make a Discord so that we can talk about that stuff in there, which has been great for, you know, facilitating more of the conversation that we love on With a Terrible Fate more broadly. But it was a lot of that where, as this regular Pottery said, the burden of being the first to finish is, yes, you avoid spoilers, but then you have to listen to everyone else talk about it as they're working their way through, and you have to stay silent.
You then have to avoid being the spoiler, which
I know.
I will say the nice thing about Discord is that you can like tag and
spoiler
block
text,
things in spoiler, which is pretty great.
Yes.
But man,
I know.
Yeah,
I wish there were a way to censor actual speech in that way. But give it 5-10 well, years. We'll figure it out.
We'll get there. I think we can both. We did a lot of kind of pre-conversation, just kind of, for lack of a better term, just kind of gushing about it because, man, what a good video game.
I'm nervous, Dan. I'm nervous that we did pre-conversation for so long. Now we're not going to have a single thing to say to each other about it.
We've exhausted
the well.
I have good news. You could wake me up from a deep sleep and I could talk to you about Final Fantasy VII. So,
okay, but what's the good news?
The good news is I'm sleeping now.
Ah, in my restless dreams, I see that Buster Sword.
I see Nibelheim. I see those.
It's kind of like a giant knife.
I see those increasingly important and prescient Norse myth references in this game.
Yeah, oh, true.
Well, yeah. So we have a lot to talk about, but we don't have infinite time. So what I thought would be fun is we wanted to talk about kind of the big ideas that we got from this game, maybe just a handful of them, things that, you know, could potentially be articles and I'm sure will eventually be articles, because this series is very near and dear to both of our hearts, Final Fantasy, largely speaking, but then also the Final Fantasy VII universe. And man, it did not disappoint. There's a lot to dive into in this one. So,
no, I think that's even before getting to the big ideas, I think big impression that for me is worth foregrounding. And yeah, we're fucking super fans, so I guess take it with a grain of salt. But I think one of the things that was perhaps most macroscopically impressive to me about this was that it was such an insanely hyped up release, of course. Everyone was so excited for it. Everyone did not know what was going to happen. And I think the experience for me of playing it was just this really dazzling and magical combination of not knowing what to expect at every turn, being surprised by things that weren't even on my radar, having great nostalgia for the things I'd always loved about the game. Like, I think it's so rare, especially in the recent days of gaming and just pop culture, with the way that hype cycles can kind of exhaust you before something comes out, to have experiences where you sit down with the thing and it's truly as if all of the hype has just kind of revved your engine in the way that you rev a chocobo at the start of a chocobo race, right? Mm-hmm. And every single thing just is like, well, there's more pathos and heartbreak to this experience than the analogy, but it's kind of like just, you know, wandering through Disney World once they open the gates, right? Where, you know, whether it's familiar stuff, whether it's new stuff, I am sure there are people who are going to sit down and play this and just be really coldly analytical and critical and thinking about, you know, why the authors chose to do what they did. But I think for people who have any semblance of attachment to the series, it is much easier to just fully sink into the experience and fall in love with it for everything you've been through before, and also for what this is, especially since the kind of initial surprise of Remake is now over, and so people kind of understand the table stakes. I feel like I felt it through the community for that reason as well, in a way that I didn't with Remake.
I saw a lot of discourse before this came out where that was the tenor of it, where people were saying, okay, well, now we know, right? Now there's yeah. no kind of mystery about it, or there's no gut punch of like the change that's being made, because we're yeah. in the Remake now, so we know that things are going to be different. And you and I loved all the differences that Remake did for various reasons. And I feel like most people have come around on it. And if they haven't, they're not playing this anymore, which good, you know, like you don't have to play everything and have an opinion on it. So I think that I shared the same feeling with you. And what it cemented for me was there were moments in it where I felt like, so a lot of RPGs, I'll feel like, oh, these are my friends, these characters. I know these people, right? And there was something that transcended that with me in this one, where I felt like they were family, because the dynamic in this game is very familial. But the way the characters are written, the way that they're animated, the way that the voice actors in English and in Japanese just bring life to them, I think, like, the familiarity that I felt with it went beyond that kind of like camaraderie and into, oh, these people feel like we're on a road trip, like doing, you know, kind of familial things and kind of looking out for each other in that sense. And I just, I don't think I've ever felt that before so palpably than I did in this one. And it was really special.
Yeah. I'm really excited to, play through it again right away, because I haven't done the hard mode New Game Plus or anything like that, but also just to go back to Remake and replay both of them in tandem with one another, because I think there are a few things that strike me as really interesting that we're digging into right now. One is, I think perhaps part of why people are now more ready to go along for the ride is something I hadn't considered back years ago when I was wondering, okay, how might the game be different if it were split into three games? Is, I think, especially on this release schedule, with there being a number of years between each game, it is almost like, had they just done a single game with a remake, I'm sure it would have like always been mired in the controversial reception and people who couldn't separate it from the original and see it on its own terms. But with it standing up instead as a trilogy, it is now, I think, in this fun and interesting space of being just a current and ongoing series within the Final Fantasy corpus, right? And so I think that makes it easier for people to go along with it on its own terms. And because of the scope and magnitude of it too, I sense that probably a big part of why you're able to have that familial experience that you mark out is because of everything that the characters already went through and the arc that they overcame and the fate that they defeated in Remake, right? Because I think if we're on the same page in terms of our experience with Rebirth, which I imagine we probably are, that sense of familial attachment is something that inheres to Rebirth, whereas it really didn't come up much at all in Remake, right? That felt to me more like the traditional dynamics of what you would expect from these characters in the original. And so that almost feels like part of perhaps what they overcome based on the, what they overcame rather, based on the conclusion of Remake.
Yeah, I think that the feeling I got was Red 13, when he shows up at the end of Remake, it's so cool to see him, and it's cool to see him there because you know that that's when they meet and everything. And there's a little bit of banter between him and Barrett. There's a really funny line actually, which with the reveal of like how Red 13 or Nanaki is, how he is in terms of maturity kind of puts it in perspective. Like, I don't know if you remember this line, but when they're getting in the truck to get on the Midgar Expressway to escape from Shinra, Barrett's like, you know, this piece of shit's falling apart. And Red turns around and goes, says the, you know, 300-pound sack of it. And it's like, like, that's a funny line, but it's even funnier when it's like, this is basically a 15-year-old boy trying to sound tough, you know? Right. So there's moments like that, but to me, they felt like, okay, I am drawing on what I know of these characters to kind of imbue them with this sense of camaraderie. Whereas to your point, what they went through at the end of Remake instantly binds them in a way that makes it feel more natural than it did, to the point where even though technically all that's happened between that moment and when we see them is like a truck ride from the outskirts of Midgar to Calm, it feels like 4 years have passed for them too. And like they've gotten to know each other that much during that time and be that comfortable with one another.
I think it's one of those cases that is actually helped by the time and space between releases, because it's one thing to say and to show in the narrative with the whispers and the way that Remake concludes, okay, now these characters are free from the preconceptions of their story and they're going to do whatever. But I think part of what I felt going into Rebirth was that you know, I replayed the whole series, all the Final Fantasy VII stuff back when we lectured on it a couple of years ago. And then I had thought, should I do that right before Rebirth? And in one sense, just my schedule of other things got in the way. But in another sense, I found myself saying, man, you know, I kind of want to go into it with just the familiarity I already have, but without it super duper fresh, because, you know, the conceit of Remake's ending, as I read it, was that now these characters are going to have the space to move on and do what they want. And I want to give them that space. And so knowing the story quite well, but also not having been back to it in a little while, I felt like I was kind of more prepared to re-encounter them and reacquaint myself with them on their own terms, which I think was a cool way that just the, you know, rather than the release schedule being a necessary evil and everyone sitting on their hands waiting for it, it actually perhaps helped to contribute to a lot of the themes it was concerned with.
No, I'm very happy about the time. And honestly, like, I hope it's not this long, but it could be like a decade before the end of that. Because if they put that, clearly they made that time matter and work, because I feel like there's no fat on this game. And that's saying something for like a 150 plus hour insane JRPG, but I feel like they really...
So we should talk about that though, because I want to devil's advocate this, because this is actually one of the things on my relatively short list to write about. So you say there's no fat on the game. I, by the way, being Aaron Stuco, hi, I don't know if you've met me, I'm inclined to agree with you, but I can hear a lot of people saying, dude, you're telling me there's no fat on a game with 88 trophies for all the nonsense hidden secret levels of mini games that you have to get through across hundreds of hours. Like, how does that feel fatless to you?
I will say, so yeah, that's a weird thing to say in a massive game, but I'll also say that I think that it's the economy of storytelling that they're using with the kind of pointed nature of what they're trying to go for. And I feel like this is, they're in a really unique position as storytellers because they do have all of that work that you just mentioned, like all of the preceding games to kind of draw from. And I feel like we live in a world where when that exists, you get a product that is, first of all, a product, and it is jam-packed with, oh, I get that, or, oh, I understand that. And usually the way that comes out in video games is quests that are only references, characters that feel out of place because they don't jive with the story that the game is telling, just because they need to be there as almost like a cameo. I don't get that sense in, I didn't get it in Remake and I don't get it in Rebirth. And I was honestly worried about it a little bit because of how much bigger Rebirth is than Remake. And I just felt like there was, anytime a character showed up, it felt like it was earned and it felt like the work you put in to see them made it make sense and made it fun. Anytime there was like a cheeky line reference, it was in the context that the original line was in and it made sense. It wasn't just like shoehorned in just to be funny. So I guess when I say there's no fat on it, I think that's maybe what I'm referencing is the kind of tongue-in-cheek meta commentary that plagues so much of everything now. I did not get that in this game. And to me, I saw a quote from, not Hironobu Sakaguchi, but Sakaguchi, first name I'm forgetting, the current Sakaguchi working on Final Fantasy VII. He said, like, I think that people could pick this up without having played Remake and understand what is happening. And I think he's right, which is crazy to say from a game that picked up from Remake.
That is crazy. I don't know if I buy into that, because I will say I was especially given not just the breadth and depth of content in Final Fantasy VII's corpus, but also just the complexity intrinsic to it. I was very nervous, even as someone who knows it quite well, of going into this and feeling like I was keeping my head above water the whole time. And I did feel like, and perhaps this is what he was referring to, I felt like it was easy for me to follow and like I didn't have to, you know, have the Final Fantasy wiki up and following along in order to get all the references or something like that.
And maybe it felt, what he meant,
yeah, and it felt thematically clear when they were weaving in different things, like, you know, we were micro gushing about, oh, that's a horrible turn of phrase, excuse me, but we were preemptively celebrating in a way which I'm sure will be followed later by more celebrations, how cool Cisne was. Not micro gushing about Cisne, that's the wrong way to say that.
No, we were pre-gushing about Cisne.
Oh my god. Now I find my mind is just bound to Cisne and I can't get away.
And gushing.
But, so, I feel like I could manage all of that as much as my my verbiage now might be suggesting otherwise. But I had the other side of that thought in terms of what at least the letter of what he said was in terms of saying you could go into this without having played Remake, because you probably remember this. I had the experience actually of sitting down and playing Remake for the first time with someone who had never played any Final Fantasy before. And she was able to follow along virtually all of it. You know, some of the Sephiroth stuff was really all that went over her head. And when, you know, a random animatronic cat showed up, that was basically it. Yeah. But with this, I found myself saying over and over again, this is so cool. I feel like they're building on it in the best way to add new layers of exegetical content into, you know, this great, really emotionally resonant story and all the things that we've said. And I feel like it's the perfect true example of a game that really does come with homework that is warranted and earned, but that you have to do because there's no way you're going to be able to follow along otherwise. So I would be staggered to see anyone who went into this as like baby's first Final Fantasy.
No, yeah, that seems crazy to me. Yeah.
No. I don't even know what the appeal would be. Like, you would have to be willfully masochistic or trying to do it as a prank, I think, to show up playing this. Whereas with Final Fantasy VII Remake, like, I can understand people who are expecting that to be the kind of thing that they could do that with in a different way, and then like had a different kind of experience and were frustrated. Like I can conceptually appreciate that. If you're doing that with Rebirth, then something has gone wrong in your head before you picked up the game.
Well, let's get into some of the more kind of interesting, chewy parts of it, because there's a lot going on in it. And one of the big ideas that I want to kind of lock into, is who is Cloud in this series, in this game particularly, and kind of where does he stand as a character? Because there's a lot going on with him. I mean, there's a lot going on with him in any version of Final Fantasy VII, but in this one specifically, I feel like it's such a layered look at what this guy is, what happened to him, how he got to where he is, who he is, what he kind of latches onto. And I get the sense that they are, they're trying to redo a lot of really cool stuff that the original game did for people who are very, very familiar with the original game. And the biggest example of that is obviously what happens to Aerith, because that's really fascinating. And it's, I think, as confusing and a gut punch as what happens to her in the original. And I was saying before we started recording, I think that that's true of Cloud too, because if you think of where Rebirth ends, comparable to the original story, if you've never played the original story and you don't know anything about it, you don't know who Cloud is or what's going on with him, right? You don't know that he is a Shinra infantry that got experimented on by Hojo and is kind of glommed on to Zack's memories and has this connection with Sephiroth, right? You don't know that. You think that what he's telling you is true and there's some missing pieces, but you also don't know, is he an agent of Sephiroth? Like, what's he doing? He gave him the black materia, so what's going on? You know, and then you don't play as him for a while. And I think that confusion is so hard to recreate. And the way that they've done it, because I would argue they did, is they really, to me, have asked the question, who is this guy? We don't know what his character is, really. Like, we know what we've seen in the story, but whenever a character like Aerith or Tifa tries to peel the curtain back, they're met with almost violent derision and confusion and like this empty sadness that really points to, man, are they going to do the same thing as before? Mm-hmm. Or are they trying to do something different? And my idea is that they're basically trying to, I don't know what they're going to do, but what I think that they're pointing at and what they're trying to make us question is, what does it mean to be a main character in a game like this, in a series like this? Cloud is incredibly unique in that way, because there are so few characters I can think of that are as malleable and interesting as Cloud is. And man, are they doing a good job of it at the end of Rebirth.
You know, I hadn't put these pieces together until we started talking about it now, but as you know, because we talked about it before Rebirth came out, we had this big discussion back and forth, actually on the podcast too, about, oh, should we play the demo? Should we not? Right. And we both ultimately, I think largely thanks to your brother, unsurprisingly, decided to sit down and play it first. And one of the things that struck me at the time, and then I kind of put out of my head because I didn't know what to do with it, was that especially if you are familiar with the production quality from Remake and how over the top blockbuster quality all of the, you know, voice acting and everything else is, it's a very weird quality to that Nibelheim sequence, especially as a demo. Tell me if you agree, but it screams this to me. That's right, where Cloud is telling the story when they're heading to Calm at the beginning of what eventually becomes the main game, where it almost seems like as Cloud is recounting the memory, he's like an intro acting student reading off a script, right? Like, it is so affected and out of place in time and feels weird and hackney, and just it doesn't compute nor coalesce with the rest of the performances that we get. No. And I found myself thinking, like, well, you know, that has to be saying something. I don't think that's something that is an accident. And we know the caliber of this voice actor from everything else. What's his name? Do you know his name? I want to be able to use his name.
I don't know.
Okay. Well, guy who's voicing Cloud.
Mr. Cloud.
We know Mr. English Cloud is very good at clouding and voice acting. But it's so interesting, speaking of bookends and the way in which Rebirth gets you to think about this, because you have that. And I think it kind of plays a trick on you, because whether you're a newcomer or someone who's familiar with the series, you're watching for other bits of variation in Nibelheim. You're drawn in by the experience of getting able to play as Sephiroth for an extended period of time. There's a lot else to distract you from that initial impression. Then you go through this whole massive adventure for 100 hours, and then it's back at the end where you kind of get back on the tracks of a thing that would be familiar from the original, but as you say, is now in a very different context of Sephiroth saying, you know, don't cry, like you can drop the act, like you're not capable of emotions, stop putting on these airs in this show, right? And I think, as you're saying, like the way in which they're using the like the further resources that are available for something like a Rebirth and even Remake before it to hit very similar notes in very different ways, I think is daunting and cool and concerning, and makes me feel uncomfortable in a lot of analogous ways to the original. Even with stuff like, I mean, this is probably more in the gushing camp than the analytical camp, but I think they dovetail just everything they did playing with like action commands and button prompts, especially around, you know, everything that happens with Aerith at the end versus like the way in which you sort of lost control and saw Cloud Seed control in the original, like really, really interesting and cool how they have not only translated that into a modern design language, but also used it to further probe the themes than the original did in a way that has, you know, created the nuance of this remade version of events since the remake came out in 2020.
Well, I think that they're in such a great position to, like, so we talked a little bit, I don't think this was on the podcast, but we've talked before about like the point of surprise in narrative, right? Sure. And like, yeah. or a twist. And I think that there's, as I grow older, I can't think of many twists that I feel like add to the theming of a story. Like there are some that are fun. Like I think The Sixth Sense is fun, but I don't know that, like, I guess that's the closest I can think of off the top of my head, but so many twists, you kind of go, oh, okay. Right. And what I think is so brilliant about this remake series is that they're able to provide that feeling of like the rug being pulled out from under you by showing you what you already know, but by doing it in a way that's like, there is so much discourse and like, and questioning, are they going to kill Aerith? Are they going to kill Tifa? You know, hey, that trailer with Sephiroth saying, is that really Tifa? Is that like a tee up to get her killed? Like, is that what the difference is going to be? And spoiler, no, it's not any of that. Like it's something way weirder and more interesting and cool and confusing and like leaves you in the same kind of emotional feeling that you had in the first game at the end of the first disc when Aerith dies. And I think that that's really special to the point where not to put too fine a point on like the Star Wars discussion, right? But I feel like the end of The Last Jedi did something similar where it's like, and you can argue how successful it was, but the kind of reveal at the end of Empire Strikes Back being that Darth Vader is Luke's father, and the reveal at the end of The Last Jedi being that Rey is nobody, is the same gut punch and confusion of like, oh, what? I was expecting something different. And I think that kind of poetic gut punch is what this game has really successfully done in a way that I wasn't expecting and yet feels so perfectly executed. And I feel like this is such a great cliffhanger. I'm upset I can't just pop in the third disc.
But man, you have to give it time. That's what we're saying. There's value to that.
Because I'm sitting with that, who Cloud is at the end of this, and how little I feel I know who he is now. And that's disorienting. In the same way, it's disorienting to start playing as Sid, you know, when you pick up,
sure,
when he leads the team for a little bit.
I think, yeah, there's something really cool about that disorientation. And I think the thing that I really found myself marveling at going through Rebirth, thinking about what I was expecting and what I didn't get after Remake, and this ties in kind of with where I'm excited to see them go next, and also what you're saying about Cloud's character and identity. I had one of those moments that I know we both love, where it's not so much a plot twist per se, but that revelation of saying, I can't believe they did what now seems like the most obvious thing, and yeah, I never even thought of it. Because if you go back and you read like my work on Remake, which I stand by, you know, I got so excited at the prospect that, okay, these characters are now free from the expectations that are put upon them by a plot at the end of Remake, and now they're free to just do whatever. And so it's an open and terrifying question what they're going to end up doing. How cool and obvious, but something that I never even considered, that like the bigger problem they would be creating was opening themselves up to every possibility, because they're no longer tethered to a story and being trapped in this manifold of all possible things happening and therefore nothing really mattering. And this is where I think it also connects in a really cool way that I definitely want to work through and probably publish on with Cloud, is this idea that I also think there is something kind of unexpectedly subversive that it does with the kind of choice that we as gamers have gotten familiarized with over the last 10 to 15 years with stuff like Mass Effect, right? You go through Rebirth and there are a million pretty obvious, like Mass Effect kind of inspired dialogue wheels for Cloud as you're
making
decisions. That's right. Not interested. I'm not answering that. My hair is very spiky. That's right. So I think there's this really cool thing that I'm trying to unpack and get to the heart of in terms of what the game is doing with that. Because I think when you get to the end and you see where things end up, and you also see, by the way, what is opened up to you in New Game Plus in terms of what you can do, I think there's a deep and very scary sense in which it's suggesting to you, on one level, those choices don't really matter, because there's a scenario in which they all play out and you're never really backed into a corner in terms of the choices that you make, because do they influence your relationships? Yeah. You know what else you can do once you're done with the game? You can go load up chapters where relationships matter and just fine tune them to whatever you want to get the outcomes that you want. We have created a world based on the outcome of Remake where all of these different outcomes and ways in which things could go have kind of equal standing. And when there's that manifold of all these possible outcomes, what's left to anchor your identity, right? And so I don't think it's a coincidence. And I think it's actually really importantly resonant that this is the kind of story that is now being built on top of Final Fantasy VII with an avatar who is, you know, like you say, the paragon, no pun intended, with Mass Effect, of being like faceless and senseless and a puppet, in that other really memorable line that we got again in kind of the same kind of a different context in Rebirth.
I think the anchor that I'm excited for, and we haven't talked about this, but you know, I'm going to say it's my boy, it's Zach. Zach is the, you know, we joke about like, oh, you must imagine Sisyphus happy. Like, man, there's Zach, you know? Like, I think that at the end of this game, I read something really interesting where they were, the creators, again, I think it was Sakaguchi was saying, or maybe it was Hamaguchi, one of the Gucci's, they were saying that, you know, oh, we didn't bring Zach back because he's popular. We brought him back because he's important to the story we want to tell. Mm. And I think that, there's an important lesson in that, because you should ask the question like, okay, why was the Sephiroth fight at the end of Remake? Well, X, Y, and Z reasons. Why did Zack show up at the end of Rebirth? Well, X, Y, and Z reasons. And I think, I think you're spot on, Aaron, with like this, the terror continues into nihilism of like, what does anything matter if everything can happen? Right. And I think that my read on Sephiroth at the end of this game is he's kind of like, join the entropy with me, Cloud, like, you know, lay into how meaningless everything is. It'll be super cool. Right. And Zack, on the other hand, the last time, and you know, I'm big on first and lasts, right? The last time we see Zack, he's in the church and it's bright and he's excited to see the next thing. And I think in a world of nihilism, that's how you get out of it, right? I mean, you'd know better than me, Mr. Philosophy, but I would say that like, that is the answer to where you go. And I think that's so great that he's there and that he can continue to be this, using your word, paragon for Cloud. And I'm so interested to see how that's going to shape out, right? Because Cloud kind of becomes realized at the end of Final Fantasy VII through remembering Zack. Well, what does that look like in a world where Zack's standing right there? You know, they kind of played around with that in ways that I want to look into a lot more, but man, it's just, it's like a question that they had to answer in a way that no one was thinking. And the answer they chose was like, let's just make it really interesting and cool instead of fan servicey and annoying.
It's funny because you said, you have to look to your boy for the answer. And I think Zack is the perfect picture of optimism and cutting a way out of nihilism. But I actually thought, because this has been on my mind, I thought you were going to go to your other boy, Sid.
Roche?
Because, okay, third boy then. You have too many boys, yeah. Dan.
I have to, yeah. They're all my boys. That's my play. They're all my boys.
My boys. My boys are back in town. All my sons, but all my boys. And it's
all my boys. Yeah.
Oh my
Fitting
God.
For Sid with plane parts. Anyway, continue.
That's true. I was thinking about that great sequence that you get near the end of the original where everything is coming to a head and they're resolving what they need to do and why. And I think it's one of the moments that we talked about, or you talked about back in our lecture on Final Fantasy VII, that scene on the Highwind where it's after they've gone to space and Sid has seen his dream fulfilled. And he said, you know, I felt like the planet was almost too vast and too big to be able to do anything and make a difference. But then when I was out there in space, it made me think about it in a different way, seeing how small and scared it is in this empty space. And it really makes more sense to think of the planet as a kid that we have to protect and do what we can. And I, as I was sitting after the game and trying to make sense of what the heck the thing I just played for, you know, 110 hours was trying to say, I got that sense. And so I hope in one way or another, that's where it's going. And it feels for that reason, like something that is deeply Final Fantasy VII and already contained within the original, even though they go about it in a very different way, this idea that, well, if everything is equally possible, that's not to say that what you choose to do doesn't matter. Rather, it's the opposite. You have special standing to decide that these are the specific things you want to do in your life and where you want to find the meaning in order to build the kind of value in the world that you want and that you want to see both in yourself and others. And that kind of, you know, flight to intrinsic value from all of the like contingencies and like convoluted outcomes that the world forces upon you, to me, has always been like right at the heart of what Final Fantasy VII as a series is wrestling with. And I think, you know, I'm so excited to see where they go with it this time around, because it's like, so the way that I made sense of getting into some of the later stuff in the game, the way I made sense of sort of what was going on with what I feel like Genova is trying to do is that I think it's obviously important because they added this big whole epic set piece about it. what the Gi were doing on the planet and what it is that they are trying to achieve now.
Where they came from.
With the Black Materia, where they came from.
They were basically, not to cut you off, but for context, like the way that they explain it is that, okay, if Genova was the calamity that came from the skies, the Gi were basically like, you know, you hear stories about how, oh, maybe life started on Earth because an asteroid hit Earth and there was bacteria on it. Okay. What if there was just a big planet that ran into our planet and a bunch of people walked off on it? That's what the Gi are.
It was so cool, that whole sequence. Yeah. I think I told you this, Dan, but so Cosmo Canyon, from planetology to everything that happens with Nanaki and his dad to Bugenhagen, is just like one of my favorite ideas in a video game story. It just hits all the right notes for me.
I have a note on Bugenhagen and something Tifa says to him. So I just want to put a pin in that because that goes back to what you were saying earlier, but continue.
We'll
about
put a
the
pin
Gi.
In it. I was obviously like in a ball weeping on my couch when everything happened with Nanaki and Seto, and learning the truth about what his dad had did. And then for the chief of the Gi to show up and be like, "Hey, you don't know me, but I'm going to take you on a magical mystery tour and tell you all this stuff you didn't know before." I went from weeping to
especially
losing my mind.
It's Gi Natak, the boss. Like, you just fought him, mm-hmm. and he just shows mm-hmm. up like normal. Mm-hmm. He's like, "Hey, man, come with me for a second."
Totally different. Totally different. And talk about a way of like intelligently fleshing out a concept that was basically just like the boogeyman that the clan had to fight in the original and was
They were inconsequential. Yeah. They were literally
little sideshow.
Like, yeah. They weren't anything special other than like another, you know, monster type on the planet that, you know, that Seto and his family fought. Now they're this extraterrestrial race that is barred from the life stream because they didn't come from the planet. Mm-hmm. So they're just like living in limbo. And they literally say, because I did play this part again, they literally say, "We don't want to exist, but rather to not exist. We want cessation from existence because this is literally hell."
So, and now take the pin out of what I was saying about Genova, because I think, and this maybe this constitutes theory crafting, I think of it more as just trying to put together the thematic pieces of what it's saying. But I think that to me, that marks the clearest illumination of Genova's underlying motivations that we've maybe ever gotten in the series, because Genova is this kind
of a lot of oomph.
It's a mythic figure where you play through the original, especially, but then even, you know, sit down and watch Advent Children, play Crisis Core, dedicate your life to Final Fantasy VII, whatever. And again, you see Genova as this thing that you feel without really being able to intellectualize.
She's literally up until now, she is the thing. That's what it is. She's the thing. She's an alien that fell to Earth who can mimic other people. It's literally the thing. But in this game, go on.
Well, yeah. So what I'm feeling is, I think there's a deep and important sense in which, yeah, maybe the Gi are more human than Genova, but they share this standing of being, now what we understand to be really importantly, outside of the life stream and foreign to this world in a way that they cannot be properly taken up by it nor embraced by it. Also not really something new, right? Because we have a similar concept of geostigma coming out of Advent Children and stuff like this.
Well, I was thinking about geostigma, but more specifically, I was thinking about how the Gi Natak, the chief of this clan, said, like, he's kind of like, he's very sarcastically and like full of ire talking about the Setra, you know, the ancients, as this, you know, they call themselves the stewards of the planet, but they're the one. He kind of makes it out like they barred them from the life stream. Like they had some kind of influence on them, like not returning, because they have this like this thing against them, to the point where it's like, what I want to call out while we're saying this is that it seems like there's a potentiality where, all things being equal, anything on the planet does go back to the life stream, but because the Setra were there and they were kind of like you know, they've called themselves the stewards of the planet. They were sort of talking with the planet to say, like, hey, don't let these guys in. They're weird and creepy. We don't like them. And I'll have to go back and watch that, but that's the feeling that I got. And then when we get that sort of like the parallel to the Shinra ancient slideshow that you get in the Shinra building, but it's put on by the Cetra and they're explaining the war with Genova and how the humans killed the Cetra and everything. It's like literally the story of the Gi again, where it's just, we're fighting this thing. Genova's clearly scarier, but we're fighting this thing that won't go away and we don't want it here. And we're going to do whatever we want to get rid of it. They're doing a very strange thing with Genova in this game and giving it almost like pathos.
Yeah. Or at least a way to sympathize with it, which if you know, Genova is really dangerous. I think we should be concerned about the Cetra. It's a good point that you raise, because I think at a minimum, what I would say is, I don't feel confident in the reliability or trustworthiness of the Cetra, which is something that is radically new, because they have kind of, even as recently as Remake, been represented as something like the moral center of this world that has monsters like Shinra and Genova in it. But what I think for Genova, and I can't wait to see how they flesh it out more, but I feel like, and I mentioned this to you when we were like initially debriefing, Dan, I almost feel like there's a sense in which they're kind of like marrying some of my favorite parts of all things Final Fantasy 13 2 and Final Fantasy 9. Stay with me. There's a method to my madness.
I've never stopped thinking about Caius.
I know you haven't, buddy. I know you haven't. But you know, one of the more inscrutable lines in one of the more inscrutable moments in Final Fantasy IX is when one of Aaron's favorite boys, Necron, shows up at almost the very end, right? And explains what the heck he is and what his goal is. And he says this thing that gets no further explanation in the text, where he says his purpose is, I had to look it up to make sure I had it right. He says, I exist for one purpose: to return everything back to the zero world, where there is no life and no crystal to give life. In a world of nothing, fear does not exist. This is the world that all life desires. And he talks a lot in his, you know, longer monologue about kind of all the suffering in the world emerging from disparity and these cycles of life and death and just conceptual difference between things, right? And I think like, there's a really provocative sense for me in which I kind of want to read Genova like that, where you think about the Gi, you think about the idea of just being foreign to a place, and then square that with the parasitism of something like Genova that just wants to impress its existence on everything. And what's the logical conclusion of that? The conclusion, I think, is kind of the impetus behind what Sephiroth, or, you know, Genova's mouthpiece, like, tries to explain at the end of Rebirth, this idea, I think, of collapsing all of these possibilities that we've seen explode after the defeat of the initial Whispers into this one singular thing that maybe Sephiroth can rule as a god, but I think, I think more right now, it's like this thing that can be identical with Genova and can erase all difference and distinction. Right.
I think that's what it's setting up. And I think that, so you had said, you know, Genova's mouthpiece, right? And I think that what they're setting up, because they've really hammered in. So another big reveal in Final Fantasy VII, the original, is that the Sephiroth that you've been seeing isn't Sephiroth, right? Sephiroth's been trapped in the northern crater, his body. And it's really even questionable if he is him at the end of that, right? Because what we're seeing is, and I think it's a lot clearer in the Remake series, I've been calling them remnants because that's what Advent Children calls Kadage, Laz, and Yazoo, the remnants. But the cloaks, I think Barrett calls them, like the guys in the black cloaks, the people who are ex-soldiers or have Genova cells in them. It's clear that like Sephiroth or Genova is imprinting Sephiroth on these guys as like a, like her avatar, you know, like, hey, you recognize Sephiroth. He's big and scary.
Yeah.
Here he is. Right. And I think that to me, it's so much clearer. And I, this is my big theory that I was teasing when we were talking earlier in our pre-Gush Cisne session was the idea of like, who are we seeing and whose will is being enacted? I'm convinced it's all Genova at this point. And I'm convinced it's in line with what you're talking about, this idea of kind of resetting to zero or resetting to Genova, because she can't handle the idea of this infinity, right? And I think the answer to Genova is, so what about infinity? Like, I'm going to go have a sandwich. Stop worrying about it. And I think that what would be really interesting and what would be really, really subversive is, I was thinking about this. Are they going to go the route of Genova's cells in people makes them incapable of returning to the life stream? And I don't think they are, because there's no precedent for that in the series. Soldiers have disappeared, and you know, there's a whole idea of Genesis kind of enacting his will through the life stream before it was realized that he was still alive. So what I think...
Well, and with really, Sephiroth too, right? I mean, he enacts his will through the life stream.
Yeah, that's geostigma. That's what
makes the big problem with everything.
And with having children. So I think that what would be so fascinating is like Genova, the reunion idea, she tried and it didn't work, right? Like, I'm going to try to figure this out and kind of reconstitute myself. It seems like she's aware, like, I don't think that's the way to go. And I think it would be so interesting if the Sephiroth trapped in the Northern Crater, who like is Sephiroth, right? It's the man from Crisis Core, right? The person. If there's some cessation of Genova's will from him and she's like, I'm only using you as a puppet. I'm only using you because you're scary and people know who you are. And this Sephiroth does have his own kind of will. And I think that there's groundwork being laid for that to be a possibility of like Genova is, as you say, like this total alien force of nihilism, just coming into this world and trying to reset everything to zero. And how cool would it be if when we get to Sephiroth, like the actual guy, he's like, yeah, I don't want that. I am inherent to this world. You know, I was born of two people and I thought I was a Cetra for a while. I get what's going on. I'm a person. Like, I'm not a good guy, but I don't want that to happen. You know,
and that would be a powerful payoff as we were talking about before to why it would be important in this kind of story for someone like Zach, who knew and worked with Sephiroth, the man, to actually, you know him and be here and perhaps even call him back in one way or another, to say nothing of if Genesis ends up showing up like we were speculating about beforehand. Well,
I think there's that great moment. I like jumped out of my seat when it happened, when Sephiroth is walking into, so it's in that kind of dream world, the like one of the many possibilities where Zach is, and he's sitting outside of the church and he's like trying to, it's after he's gone through a few possibilities. He's like, man, what the hell's what's going on? Yeah. I'm just a normal dude. This is very confusing.
My brain.
And Sephiroth walks up because he's going after Aerith. And Zach gets up and he's like, ah, Sephiroth. And he's just like, he literally says, you want a piece of me? And Sephiroth turns around and goes, not of you. And then he walks inside. Uh-huh. And it's just like, that to me is such a moment from Crisis Core.
Yeah.
Where it's like that the guy who Sephiroth is shown through there for a second. And I just think that,
that's a good point.
Man, what an interesting avenue they could go down to show that even Sephiroth has gained enough interiority throughout the cycle of Final Fantasy VII that he's able to break himself from this monster. I think that would be really interesting.
That guy shining through, I want to pick up on that and put our pieces together, because, you know, where I was going before was this idea of like, if we have Genova as this kind of parasite that is trying to consume everything by like erasing the difference between herself and everything else, right? How cool and thematic and resonant with the original to have the counterpoint and resolution for the heroes be the recognition that anything is possible, And that's what gives value to their choice to do this rather than that. So to have that comfort and sense of empowerment exactly from all of those disjunctive possibilities, and then to show what it is to conquer something like Jenova by perhaps not even Sephiroth redeeming his will per se, but maybe even everyone who's been kind of cursed and afflicted by Jenova finding their sense of individuality again. So, you know, one thing that struck me, and I didn't know what to do with it, but I feel like it resonates with what you're saying about Sephiroth, is just the level of care and sympathy that was afforded all of the robes in Rebirth. There are so many really touching and sad portraits of them in terms of people who would become them, or people whom you never knew and are just suffering in this less than existence and being abused by people where the party has to come in and stand up for them. I think the game really wants you to not just think about the way in which people can be used as puppets, which of course is, you know, one of the big themes in that section of the original game, but also think about the kinds of kindness and just human attention that can pull someone out of that state of puppetdom. And so I can't imagine they resolve that in a way that does not reconceive of Jenova and her relationship with all of these people who are actually native to the life stream and the planet.
Well, and I think that, man, what a beautiful story, because, you know, you see that every one of those robes, the cloaks, whatever they're called, the remnants, they were people as much as Cloud was. And I think like the innkeeper in Calm, or, I mean, really the heartbreaking one for me, as I know, you know, is Roche. And just this, like, and that's something I think I'm going to have to wrestle with a little bit more, because I think it does fit into this kind of schema we're building about Jenova being like the nihilistic, like, conglomerator of things, because Roche is such a realized character as soon as he shows up. Like, you know exactly who Roche is, and I love him for it.
Oh, yeah.
And you just get, he's theatrical, and he's like big, larger than life, and he loves his motorcycle. And there's like flavor text where it's like, Roche never rose in the ranks of soldier despite being capable, because he wouldn't take on jobs that didn't require his motorcycle. So like, he's, you know, there's like these little things like Shinra dossiers and stuff. You get this moment in this game where he basically gives in to Hojo's experimentation. And I still need to kind of figure out what like logistically happened in the world of Final Fantasy VII to him, because it seemed like it was like a soldier enhancement, but I'm pretty sure Roche was already a soldier. So maybe it was like they're setting up that different classes get different enhancements. That might be it. I don't know. But
I assumed it was a different kind of cell, right? Because there's it more than one cell being passed around with the different cloaks. That was a big part of this that they talked around a lot.
They did. Yeah. And he had like, he got a tattoo that said SC1 on it.
Right.
So I don't know if that, maybe that's like Sephiroth cell one, like, cause in the lore of Final Fantasy VII, the only successful Sephiroth clone, I'm doing air quotes, and not Jenova clone, is Cloud.
Right.
And so, the idea that, well, and Zach technically, but whatever, the idea that Hojo basically did what he did to Cloud, but to Roche in a very short matter of time, says to me this like this interesting dynamic where I didn't get the sense that Roche was like aching for that. And he ends the fight with Cloud very magnanimously. He's like, you win again, you know, but next time I'm going to catch you. And I need to do a closer reading of it, because to me that resonated very much with his character of like, I just am interested in what I'm interested in, and I have my own goals, which is very antithetical to Jenova. So to see him kind of become a cloak was devastating, because here's this guy who's so individualized that when he kind of, you know, takes the forbidden fruit of whatever Hojo is doing, it just like seals his fate as a nobody, to use a Kingdom Hearts term.
And if he broke were becoming a Sephiroth clone, because that was kind of how I read that too, because otherwise his I don't know how like to it. Make sense. Yeah. And otherwise, like, yeah. What are the further cells that are being injected? I think I'm with you on that. But I feel like that perfectly resonates with everything that we're mulling over here, because, you know, knowing someone like Roche and the things that he values, especially in Rebirth, how he doubles down on the value of his rivalry with Cloud.
Yeah.
Wouldn't it make sense if maybe he ends up, you know, going to the scientist who made Cloud into what he is and finds a way to become even more like Cloud, to become more of his perfect rival? Wouldn't it be deeply ironic and tragic if that actually robbed him of the will that motivated that in the first place? And then wouldn't it be so cool, especially given how he was, you know, elevated to even more prominence in this plot than he was in Remake, if actually that ends up becoming part of how he might even help call Cloud back to individuality and find a way out of the Genova trap for everyone in where we might go next.
I think that I love the idea so much that this ends with, you know, the people who were, because, okay, I have maintained ever since I picked up Final Fantasy VII, that if you play through those games, Sephiroth is not the bad guy. I would say Genova is not the bad guy. I would say even Shinra is not the bad guy. Hojo is the bad guy. And I think that...
Hojo and Corneo.
Corneo. We got the lines.
That's right.
But Hojo is so evil, in the sense of like taking this otherworldly thing and imbuing life with it in this monstrous Frankensteinian way. And I think that what I really would love to see is redemption for the people that he hurt. And it would be even cooler. And I would think it would give more meaning to the end of Crisis Core as well. Because, as we all know, infinite mystery is the gift of the goddess. But in the kind of framework that we're working with here, I think you could interpret that the gift of the goddess is individuality. And it is like this idea of having your own sense of self, which Bugenhagen, taking the pin out of that conversation from earlier, explicitly says, like, no, we're not just like, you know, mindless drones. Like, we're all different, and we're not... It's not like we're reincarnated from people in the past. We're ourselves, and the planet is kind of experiencing life through us, and we experience the planet likewise. And I love this idea that, you know, as you say, Roche kind of calls Cloud back, this idea of like the gift of the goddess, the gift of the planet being given back to people who had their sense of self ripped from them, is that they get that back. And that's really the beauty of not just the planet, but of life in this world, right?
Yes. I do. God, everything they did with Bugenhagen was so interesting. You know, I imagine this connects with what we've been talking about, but I'm not quite sure how. But one thought that I had, which must have been on my mind back when I first played Final Fantasy VII, but it wasn't something that I had thought about in a long time, is, you know, there's something that's kind of interesting and weird but satisfying, I would say, about this idea that in that section that I said I love so much, Cosmo Canyon, and just the fabric of Final Fantasy VII's world, there's this whole discipline of planetology, right, that understands the flow of the life stream on the planet and has this big observation system to look outwards. And yet, in all of the outward observation of space, and even with, you know, lines like Cid's that we were talking about earlier, all you get from looking outward is a better understanding of inward, right? It's not a game that is predominantly concerned with a huge cosmos and a bunch of planets, like, well, call out Mass Effect again, right? It's concerned with using whatever means are available in order to understand your context and present state and the ecosystem that you inhabit, right? And so I do wonder, as we think about like the new directions which we've been in and where it might go next, and especially stuff like the Gi and just building out that corpus of things that have come from beyond. Like, I wonder whether it's going to keep turning inward in the same way, or kind of, especially with like the other realities, timelines, outcomes, whatever you want to call it, that we have now, like how far outside the life stream and the planet and the now are we really going to be called to go before we wrap back inward and see, you know, how it changes things in the context that we know and love on the planet?
I do wonder. I think I think it would have been boring to just, and I know people, I don't want to upset people who feel that they were cheated out of this, but I genuinely think it would have been boring had this just been a one-to-one remake, and we wouldn't be able to ask these questions. And I think that that Cosmo Canyon piece, the line that Tifa has, and maybe this is another article down the pipeline at some point, but something I really liked about Bugenhagen in this game is that he was kind of, instead of being the all-knowing kind of wise man that he is in the original, he's like a stodgy, kind of like stuck in his ways academic.
And fallible.
Very fallible, to the point where at the end of a couple of quests, like, he basically says, "Thank you for making me remember that I can be wrong."
Yeah.
And there's this exchange that he has with Tifa where he says, he's explaining that what the Maka reactors are doing is burning the planet's energy, and it just goes away. And Tifa is like, "Well, how do you know that it goes away? Like, what if it comes back in a different way?" And he's like, "Ha, you idiot." And then they kind of stop. And I just started thinking, like, well, but we know he's wrong, because, you know, what I think they're setting up very beautifully is that in the original game, it felt like the Setra, the ancients, were one bookend of the story, and that the meteor was the other bookend. But what they're setting up here is that the Setra can be fallible, just like Bugenhagen was, that we see with the Gi. And then we see that there's like things that happen after with humans. And this is something we didn't even talk about, but like the whole idea of the Republic of Junon and these kingdoms and cities and areas that existed before Shinra, where in the back of your head, you thought, well, of course, this is a whole planet. Like, Shinra wasn't around forever. It's two generations of Shinra men. Like, it's not like a dynasty. So, but you never thought about it in terms of like what happened before, but there's this whole history of the world that you and Chadley are exploring. And what I think that does beautifully is give way more import to the last scene of the first game after the credits, when Nanaki and his children, 500 years in the future, run up and see the remains of Midgar, and it's overgrown and taken over by the planet again. And when you see that, and you know all of the harm that Shinra did to the planet, you can't help but think that Tifa's probably right. Like, how do we know that happens? Right? And I love this idea that is expanding the boundaries of our understanding of the game too, where it's like, how do we know? Like, it's a story. What do we know? And I think that's awesome.
Absolutely. Yeah. It has me excited for where we go next. And I think this ties back to something that we talked about way back at the presentation we gave, even about the original, but I think there's something so cool simply about a game that inspires you to get really excited and passionate about critically interrogating those boundaries of what you know about it, and trying to even just see, like, you know, through a conversation such as this, what you can get thinking about and seeing in a new way through turning over a rock or asking a slightly different question about something. Like, man, talk about things that we haven't even scratched the surface of that will, you know, be a whole article series, I'm sure. But going from, you know, the whispers as a new concept to the whispers as multicolored, factional, whatever.
Yeah.
Really, really cool how
Sephiroth uses them as a gun.
Just how deft they are at expanding their worlds. Yes. I think I God, there's so many things we can say about that, but I'm kind of hoping here's my my bite-sized hope for the Whispers. I think it was so cool to have white Whispers. Great to see them fighting. Great to have the idea that, yeah, okay, there's one way in which things could go, but there are a bunch of different ways things can go. And there are also a bunch of different stakeholders and agents who might want things to go one way or another. And so, of course, mm-hmm. there are going to be different kinds of Whispers. Again, it seems so obvious once they tell you that. But like, man, how cool would it be if the conclusion that's drawn from that is not to find a way to kill all the Whispers, but for everyone to find, like, in this kind of world in Final Fantasy VII, their own personal Whisper, right? Like their yeah. principle of will for figuring out what they want to do and like creating the future that they want to contribute to with everyone else, right?
I kind of got that sense that, the Harbinger that we fought at the end of Remake yeah. was just like the status quo. And now right. like none of those Whispers went anywhere. They're just, as you're saying, attaching themselves to different people. And I love mm-hmm. the idea that eventually maybe, you know, the world of the planet, you know, it is meant to be like everybody has their own Whisper. I mean, cause their name is very important too, right? Just a Whisper yeah. of Fate saying you should go over here. And if everybody yeah. has a different one, that's a really cool way to end this story.
Yeah,
I like that idea a lot.
Well, it's the tip of the iceberg, man. And it's an iceberg that is haunting me like Genova, but in a good way.
Let's end on this because I know you have a hard out. So what was your favorite mini game? Take all the frustration outside of it. What was your favorite one?
Oh, my God. My favorite mini game. Without overthinking it, the Star Command one in the Gold Saucer.
Yeah.
That was so much fun.
That was awesome.
Just like the Buzz Lightyear guy who was like cheering you on and joined to like take on the boss. It's just like, it felt so fun. It seemed like something straight out of Disney World. I had a really easy time with it. It was the kind of thing that I was remarkably good at. So I didn't have to scream at my TV and do it for 3 hours. What about you?
I liked, that was really fun. I think probably the Chocobo Racing. I like that it was easy to understand and just customizable enough. I thought it was a lot of fun.
Yes, agreed. So, that could have so easily been overwhelming in so many ways, but it was the perfect level of complexity, as you say.
I was so happy that it made like the, what I thought was just going to be a cosmetic item, the like Chocobo gear actually matter. So anytime you can do that, I'm all for it. So in a game of 5 million mini games, which is great because if you play the original Final Fantasy VII, it's mostly mini games. So playing this one was another return to form. But just a fantastic continuation, excellent game, and lots of ideas percolating in the old percolator.
Yeah, I didn't think that the second one would get me even more overwhelmed with thoughts than the first one, but that was probably Aaron being myopic and naive.
Well, more myopia and naivete next time. With the
Terrible Fate podcast. That's the unofficial slogan. Very unofficial. Very unofficial. Don't I'm tweet that sure. out.
All right. Well, we'll see you next time, folks.
Next time.